Ron White's marriage was deemed legal, a man robs a bank using his personal stationery, and the Supreme Court deals with the F-bomb. These stories, plus part one of an interview with the funniest man in the law, Sean Carter, in this week's Debriefing of the Law. Let's start with the headlines. A California court ruled that comedian Ron White's marriage to Margot Ray was legal, and so his estranged wife can go after him for spousal support. Now, here's what happened. Margot Ray filed for divorce with Ron White. He responded by saying they were never married in the first place. Which I gotta admit, seems rather odd, because marriage is not one of those did I do it or didn't I do it kind of things. Unless a Vegas chapel is in the mix, I'm thinking a person would remember getting married. Marriage is not a matter of degree. You can't be a little bit pregnant, and you can't be a little bit married. Well, let's start with the basics of this case. There was a wedding ceremony. Invitations were sent out. Stale white cake was ordered. So, you know, this thing was happening. Well, a California judge stated, wedding invitations were sent to prospective guests. At least 300 guests attended. Their ceremony was publicized to the national media. The officiant was a minister. Vows and rings were emotionally exchanged. An official pronouncement of husband-wife status was made by the officiant under the powers granted him by the state of Texas. Heck, I didn't even get a national announcement for my wedding, so you know this has to be the real deal. What is up with vows and rings were emotionally exchanged? Is crying during the vows a prerequisite for marriage? I was numb during my entire wedding ceremony. I just didn't want to screw it up. But what did they do to make Ron White cry during the ring ceremony? Did they make him put his drink down for just 1 second? That might be too long for Ron White. He always has to be holding his drink. Well, if Ron White did cry during the ceremony, which I seriously doubt, by the way, but if he did get moist in the eyes, then what was his argument that there was no wedding? Well, White argued that he did not believe the marriage was binding because the proposed prenuptial agreement had not been signed by Ray before the wedding. Yeah, I am not sure Ron White understands the purpose of prenups. Prenups are not a prerequisite for a marriage certificate. No, it's your insurance policy for if, and in Ron White's case, when the marriage goes bad. If you are a Ron White fan, which I am, you knew this marriage had about as much chance of surviving as a White Castle cheeseburger on President Trump's dinner plate. Yeah. I'm not putting my money on the cheeseburger. Well, prenups are a lot like health insurance. You can't claim you're not sick because you failed to get insurance beforehand. You're still sick. The only difference is now you are broke and have to pay for the treatment. Same is true with the prenup. Failing to sign it does not mean you are not married. It only means that if the marriage falls apart, well, you're going to be broke and have to pay for it. All right, well, this next story is ripe with understatement. Michael Harrell, a 54-year-old Ohio man, robbed a U.S. bank in Cleveland. Now, most criminal historians are in agreement that this will not be included on any list of most impressive bank heists. Yeah, Bonnie and Clyde, yeah, you're not in danger of getting knocked off the list of great American bank robbers by Mr. Harrell. All right, here's what happened. Michael had just come from the DMV. And so the most accessible piece of paper that he had was his DMV receipt. So when he wrote his demand note, yep, you guessed it, he handed the bank teller a note that contained on the backside his name, address, and make and model of his car. Special Agent Vicki Anderson of the Cleveland Office of the FBI, who investigated this heist, said tracking down bank robbers can sometimes prove to be a difficult task. She said, a lot of times we're sending out pictures. We have no idea who this person could be or what part of town they could be from. But when you present a note that has your name already on it and address, it helps law enforcement tremendously. Yes, that, my friends, might be the understatement of the year. That was not Michael's only gaffe that day, however, you see. He decided to rob his own bank. He was a regular at this bank. The teller even called him by his name. Hey, thanks, Michael. Have a good day. Hey, see you next week. Well, I highly doubt any movies will be made over this heist. I mean, outside of a comedy, of course, I can see that movie being made, but Al Pacino will not be starring in it, that I can assure you. Well, what was his loot in this heist? He got $206 in the robbery. $206? That's not even going to cover his DMV bill. Michael, you got to do better. Well, it is not clear if Harold has retained a lawyer just yet. Now, as a lawyer, I have no idea how this charge can be defended. But a just kidding defense might actually work here. Because what criminal would be this dumb? I mean, this is like the bank teller saying, "Sir, I would be happy to give you this $206, but first I'm going to need to see some ID. It's just bank policy." All right, if it's bank policy, then here's my driver's license. Not the brightest criminal out there. All right, also this last week, President Donald Trump sued California over its newly enacted law requiring anyone running for president in California to turn over tax returns for the previous 5 years. Now, my first thought when reading about this law is, nice try, California. Do you really think anyone will think this was just a procedural rule and not a political attack on our tweeter-in-chief? I mean, why not include, plus all applicants must disclose all emails with Russia and settlements with porn stars while you are at it? I think my dog could sniff out the real motivation here. And my dog is a Shih Tzu without a fully formed nose. All right, well, I don't think California will be able to get away with this new law. You see, we have this little document that offers some suggestions, perhaps guidelines, if you will, when it comes to qualifications for certain positions within the federal government. It's called the United States Constitution, and it gives three criteria for being president. 35 years old, natural born citizen, and being a resident of the U.S. for 14 years. You see, the founders wanted to make sure that whoever was president fully understood the difference between American football and whatever it is that the rest of the world plays. What the heck is football anyways? I mean, come on, who thinks football should primarily be played with one's foot? I don't even know what a foot is. So California cannot add additional criteria like being a college graduate or surrendering your Twitter account in order to become president. Although I do think America would be willing to look the other way if any state wanted to add a surrender of one's Twitter account as a prerequisite. That is a cause I believe would unite all Americans. Time for funny moments at the Supreme Court. Now, I love to follow the Supreme Court, not just because they are establishing the parameters of our nation's laws, but also because, well, many of the justices are late-night comedian wannabes. I have documented every time there has been laughter at the high court over the past 10 years. And let me tell you, many of our justices have comedic chops. Spoiler alert for you Supreme Court aficionados, Clarence Thomas would not be one of them. Miming has yet to catch on at the Supreme Court. But during this podcast, I will regularly be bringing to you funny moments at our high court. Well, this last term, the court took up Iancu v. Brunetti, which dealt with whether the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office could refuse to issue a trademark for scandalous or immoral words or phrases. In this case, designer Eric Brunetti sought a trademark for the word F-U-C-T. Now, I am not the best at pronouncing words. Let me give this my best shot. Fusette? Fuked? Well, because I do not want an explicit label on my podcast, I'm going to leave the pronunciation up to your imagination. Just sound it out. But not in front of your children, it's F-U-C-T. But Brunetti designed hoodies, loose pants, shorts, and t-shirts, all with the brand name of F-U-C-T prominently displayed. Now, when people started to copycat this word, he sought a trademark to protect his intellectual property. Now, right now, my grandmother is rolling in her grave. The thought that F-U-C-T is intellectual property? Yeah, I am sure that has been greeted by glee by foul-mouthed teenagers everywhere. But when he sought the trademark, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office denied it under this law that prohibited the trademarking of scandalous and immoral words and phrases. Now, as a lawyer, I must admit, I was fascinated by this case. Not the legal issues, mind you, but I was very curious as to how the lawyers and the justices would dance around saying this word. Would this hearing receive an R rating? Would it make Andrew Dice Clay proud? These are the thoughts that dominated my legally trained mind. Well, let's just hear how the attorney arguing the case, Deputy Solicitor General Malcolm Stewart, referred to this word.
This mark would be perceived by a substantial segment of the public as the equivalent of the profane past participle form of a well-known word of profanity, and perhaps the paradigmatic word of profanity in our language.
Give that guy a raise. I mean, you know, several attorneys got together, all billing at $500 per hour plus. They sat around a large conference table and deliberated on how to refer to F-U-C-T in court. And they came up with, it's the profane past participle form of a well-known word of profanity and perhaps the paradigmatic word of profanity in our language. Yeah, I don't think this will catch on any basketball courts across our nation. Oh yeah, well, profane past participle, you and your mother. You won't hear Kevin Hart drop the profane past participle bomb on any network special anytime soon. The Supreme Court ruled in favor of the clothing brand saying the name F-U-C-T could be trademarked. And that, my friends, is what Ivy League trained lawyers are good for. That's why the confirmation proceedings for the U.S. Supreme Court, they're so contentious, because apparently when and where we can drop the F-bomb, well, that's an issue that is near and dear to the hearts of every American. Now, if you have not heard of Sean Carter, you are in for a treat. He is by far the funniest lawyer on this planet. Whenever I'm talking to him, I don't want it to end. I'm thinking, this is what it must be like to have lunch with Kevin Hart. Food is getting cold because, well, you can't eat while you're laughing and you're never done laughing. So here's part one of my interview with legal funny man extraordinaire, Sean Carter.
Sean, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Joel. Glad to be here.
Now, Sean is a good friend of mine. I love talking to Sean. Whenever I talk to Sean, I always am bummed we have to hang up because he is a laugh a minute. And Sean, somehow did you learn that from your days at Harvard Law School?
No, though. They tried to break me of that. That was one of the things, first courses I took, humorlessness and the law. and like all my courses, I got a C. So it worked out well for me.
No, Sean, I did a little bit digging up and I found out that you graduated from law school with about 1993, to date you a little bit. 92, okay. And I learned that a certain individual named Kavanaugh graduated from Yale in 1990. So you guys are close to being about the same age.
You know, when I do my comparisons of people, Kavanaugh usually isn't the first choice because I actually went to law school with Barack Obama.
No, you did?
Yeah, he's 1 year ahead of me in law school.
Oh, what was that experience like?
It would have been amazing if I ever met the man.
You spent 3 years with him and you never met. Was he skipping out on class?
No. What happened was 2 years. So we spent 2 years together, but he's 1 year ahead of me. And I had a chance to meet him my very first day. Right? They have a law school event for the black law students, and they have a professor's house, and you just don't trust a lot of 1Ls alone in the professor's house. So we have sort of a handler, a chaperone, that sort of shows us around and says, look, you know, that's the plastic fruit, don't eat that, that's the fireplace, don't pee in there, you know, that type of stuff, right? And she says to me, have you met Barack Obama? And I'm like, anybody else? I'm like, who the heck is Shaka Lama?
Right.
And she said, no, Barack Obama. And I look at him like, was he in a Commodore? She's like, no. And he starts to explain to me how this guy just made law review. In the understatement of the century, she says, hey, you're going to want to get to meet him. You know, he's going to be somebody someday.
Really? Back then, that's what they said.
Absolutely. Now, here's the problem is, I'm 22 years old. I just got into Harvard Law School. I'm in delusion that I'm going to be somebody someday. You don't think that I saw myself on the Joel Oster podcast as a guest one day, right? I thought I was going to be somebody, right. And I'm very arrogant, right? I'm like, look, you know what? You know, you go tell the Dalai Lama, whatever his name is, right? That, you know, if he wants someone to take him under his wing, I'll make some time for him. But, you know, find me a girl. Introduce me to Michelle.
That's right. Was Michelle in the picture then?
No, she graduated a little bit before. And, you know, the strange thing about it, so she graduated like 2 years before that. The strange part about it is that conversation happened, let's see, this is 1989, so we're talking about 30 years ago. And only one of the two of us is still telling that story.
That's right. Hey, if you talk to Barack Obama, he might be giving a very good story about the hilarious Sean Carter.
Yeah, and you know, so the story. 8 months, fast forward 8 months later, I'm reading the Wall Street Journal because at the time I thought I'd have money. So I'm reading the Wall Street Journal, and there is a very familiar picture plastered on the front page, you know, and they used to do back then a little ink stencil, and it shows Barack Obama and, you know, first black president of the Harvard Law Review. And then I realized, oops, I kind of messed up now. It was too late then. And by then, he's like a celebrity. He almost had Secret Service around him then. And, you know, being the head of the Law Review, you know, this is a guy who just, you know, nobody got to see.
Fascinating.
Was always in the Law Review. What a coincidence, I was not.
You know what, that is a fascinating story. It kind of overshadows the story that I was going to tell, because the story that I was going to tell, which, you know, really kind of pales in comparison, was my study mate in law school was on the short list of Trump's of Supreme Court picks. You know, he came out with a list of 25 potential Supreme Court justices that he would pick from that list. My study mate in law school was on that list. And so I told my son, hey, look, there's David Strauss. He came over to my house. We studied for exams together. We shared outlines. So my son looked at me and said, huh, David Strauss, he's on the short list of Supreme Court picks. Dad, what happened? He did not get his full allowance that week.
You have no idea how many times my parents have said to me, you took the wrong classes, didn't you, baby?
That's right. You came from the same class that Barack Obama did. But I got to tell you, Sean, I do love your career. I would rather do what you do than what Barack Obama does. And so, hey, I am not jealous of Michelle one bit.
Yeah, well, I have to admit, though, I have, I think, usually higher approval ratings. but now that Barack is on the speaking circuit, he gets slightly more money an hour than I do.
He's a competitor now. He's a competitor of yours.
Absolutely. He's taking speeches from me.
Well, you are the resident funny man in the world of law. But before we get there, I want to know you when. And so right out of law school, looks like you practice in mergers and acquisitions. Now, knowing you like I know you now, how in the world did you start off there?
Because I wanted to make the money. And, you know, that was, I, you know, came along in the 80s, the Wall Street time, right? This was, you know, greed is good, greed is right. And I wanted my part of the greed. And, you know, having a Harvard Law degree will allow you to get one of those jobs. I did leverage buyouts and made really rich people really richer. My most famous client there was Mitt Romney.
Really?
Bain Capital. Yeah, we did a couple of deals, and, you know, added a couple of zeros to his fortune. Not to mine, but to his. And then, you know, at the time I'm in Boston doing this work. Marius from Boston. I'm from LA. I was able to pull her 3,000 miles west, really wanted to go back out to LA and do the LA law thing, worked at a firm there, went in house, and then caught the comedy bug. And the comedy bug is basically a very, very expensive midlife crisis.
Explain that.
I mean, because, you know, so you know, I'm a corporate lawyer, right? Making corporate lawyer money with, you know, and at the time I'm in-house counsel at a publicly traded company with stock options and all the good stuff in life. And, you know, I decided I want to do stand-up comedy, which at the beginning does not quite pay quite as well as corporate law.
Nor does it seem to have anything in common. When I'm thinking of mergers and acquisitions attorney, and then I'm thinking comedian, that's like a nun transitioning to become a stripper. I'm not sure they have anything to do with one another, so I'm fascinated to see why you went from, was it a midlife crisis?
It was, and part survival, because I was the world's worst attorney. I mean that sincerely in the one sense that the most important skill, particularly for, remember, you're a litigator by trade. If you're a transactional lawyer, the really important thing is that you get all the I's dotted and T's crossed.
Yes.
Right? No one's paying you for creativity, right? They're paying you to change the names and dates and make sure that, you know, at the end, all the numbers match up.
And to be as negative as possible. You got to foresee bad things happening.
That too. And I've always had this delusion that God likes me. So that never was a good, disposition to bring into the law. Like, oh, please, that'll work out, right? That's never going to be, you know, what they're going to appreciate. And certainly, you know, I got to tell you, the fact that I've survived 10 years as a corporate lawyer is maybe my proudest achievement. And it was all due to force of personality and just being likable, right? It's like I was likable enough to endure the ridiculously bad lawyer I was, but you're not going to eventually succeed and go places that way. You can keep a job, right? People will keep you around, right? But they're not going to necessarily assign you a lot of responsibility if you're me. And so, you know, I could kind of, I used to think of it this way. It was like every day I'd come home and just sort of exhale. And be like, whew, one more day. Right. One more day I pull the wool over their eyes. Maybe I can do it again tomorrow.
That is so true. But I hear that from a lot of attorneys. It's like, man, how much longer can I continue fooling people in the big action know what I'm doing?
Yeah. And then I had this other disposition, which is really not a good thing, which is that I didn't care at all about my clients.
Okay, that's not a good thing to admit, all right? What do you mean by that?
No, I remember I said, you know, I was making really rich people a little bit richer.
Right.
No deal I ever did at the end, someone said, oh, wow, now my kids will go to college.
Right. Right?
It's not like, you know, it's the difference between a guy having $400 million and $500 million. Not at all anything that I could care. Why would I? Well, you know, I couldn't believe they cared. Right? You know, but certainly I didn't.
So what drew you then? How did the epiphany happen where one day you thought, you know, I'm going to go make money making people laugh?
Right. So this is what happened. I'm in LA, fortunately. And so it's entertainment capital. I take, you know, a stand-up class. I do some, you know, open mics at the world famous improv and all that type of stuff. And, you know, I remember thinking, if I'm good at this, I should be able to make at least as much money as the thing that I suck at. Now, it turns out that that's wrong. All right. So I start stacking, you know, my little pennies together, and I said, okay, I've got, you know, was it, you know, 6 months salary saved up. I'm now going to quit. And by 6 months, I'll have my own TV show for sure. Right. So let me go ahead and just quit my job, and I will go out and become, you know, Kevin Hart, but a tall version,
right
of Kevin Hart. And I figured, think about it, he can make it. I got a whole foot and a half on the guy, basically. I should at least be twice successful. And so I go out, and you know how that works. I'm making, you know, $25 a night, going broke very quickly. And someone says to me, Sean, you know, you should speak for these corporate groups, and our bar is having an event. Why don't you come on and speak to our bar? And I'm like, no, I've left the law for a reason. I'm not prostituting my art like that. All right, I have principles. And he said to me, well, all right, Sean, you have principles, but we have a budget.
That's right.
And he told me what it was. Now I can tell you this because it was years ago. The first time I ever did, you know, a lawyer event, I got paid the whopping sum of $500.
Okay.
which I think is actually equivalent to my lifetime earnings in the comedy clubs.
All right.
And so I'm like, I'll do it. And I did it. But I was like, you know, this is it. One time, just going to do it one time, right? And that was, you know, over 1,000 times ago.
Right. Now, did you tell your wife you were going to leave the law practice?
Oh yeah. It was a clean break. It almost was a clean break in the marriage. And she was actually very good about that. I got to give her a lot of credit for that. But she's told me in the past, she's like, you know, when you went through this whole thing and you had your little midlife 35-year-old crisis, I would have preferred, in hindsight, an affair. Had an affair, it'd been a lot cheaper. We'd still have stock options. We could have got some counseling and gone. We could have worked through that. Because it was a lean, you know, decade or so,
right.
To make it to this high level, you know, of success I've achieved right now. But at the time, you know, it was a struggle.
Now, I know that now you are a highly sought after speaker. You love to give your observations on the law from a humorous bent, but you are not a comedian. You are a legal humorist. So please explain to me the difference between the two.
It's about $4,000 a day. The difference is, and a friend of mine came up with that moniker years ago, which I, you know, love, humorist at law. And there is, I think, you know, here's the difference I've explained, or I've heard explained, is that basically a comedian, it's important to be funny. A humorist says important things in a funny way. The other dichotomy or definition I've heard is that basically a comedian makes you laugh and a humorist just makes you chuckle.
Okay, all right.
And the truth of the matter is that humorist is different in that regard. And you got the worst part of the moniker here, because think about it. Humorous basically implies that you're humorous, not peeing your pants funny.
Right.
You know, and so it allows you to actually say some serious things, you know, and not always be funny as a humorist. And it's easier to get your CLE accredited. So it's all good.
So, Sean, I was doing one class in South Carolina. But in any event, I read the evaluations afterwards, and one of the persons decided to give me this advice. Joel, don't quit your day job. Jay Leno, you're not. Ouch. That hurt. I thought, what did you think? You're coming to a continuing legal education class. You got to get credit. I don't even care. Jerry Seinfeld is not Jerry Seinfeld for 7 hours, but nonetheless, I get what you're saying.
Well, my favorite was early on, someone said, this guy has the... I think my material used to say something like, you know, Sean Carter is the comedic wit of Chris Rock and the legal acumen of Johnny Cochran, something like that.
Hey, right? That's nice.
I know. And this guy wrote in his review, Sean Carter has the legal acumen of Chris Rock and the comedic of Johnny Cochran.
Oh, my goodness.
I don't know if you do this, but when I do my you look at my evaluations, and I often don't, but when I do, I like to fixate on the bad one, all right, or two or three or 20, whatever the bad ones are. But some of them are so good. I've written people before and be like, I'm gonna steal this was good, like the guy who wrote that one. I'm like, you know, people can be quite creative in insulting you.
Oh yeah. They spend that much time, actually, I don't know, paying attention.
Well, they had 6 hours.
That's right. Well, son, you've written a book. If it does not fit, must you acquit? I am from that time period. I know exactly what you're talking about. The good old white Ford Bronco chase.
Oh, absolutely.
So, and I know you made observations throughout the years. So just tell us a story that maybe gives us some wonder if we're ever going to make it in the world of law. One that just makes us question the entire legal profession. You have to have stories to tell.
Well, and you know, a lot of those come in recent days. And I know you do a lot of these in your seminars as well. The things that lawyers do.
Yes.
And I, you know, I do every year an annual Ethi Awards, the best of the worst of legal ethics.
Okay.
And, you know, we give awards and prizes. And right now, I have my oldest son who's now in the business looking up things and forwarding me, you know, ridiculous cases from last year. And he keeps coming to me and saying, you know, Dad, are you sure these are real? Right? This has to be right. I'll give an example of one that you and I covered together a long time ago. We have from just last year. Remember the guy, the lawyer who wanted to go hot tubbing with the clients,
yes,
but didn't own his own hot tub?
Right.
So he decided he would just hop over the fence into the neighbor's hot tub when the neighbor was out of town,
right,
not realizing that everybody in the 21st century has cameras. Now, in addition to how ridiculous it is, say to the client, hey, I'm going to handle your civil matter, and by the way, let's strip down into the get to hot tub, right, is the idea that he's boosting her over a fence, right, to try to get
at some point in that time, you got to be thinking, you know what, it's time to get a new lawyer. I am thinking that somewhere along that the time frame, the client should have thought, now maybe it's the time to get a new lawyer.
Absolutely. And you would think that as lawyers, we would have, you know, understand, particularly the laws of employment, you know, we wouldn't be part of the Me Too generation, or at least, you know, the offending side of the Me Too generation.
Right.
But it's time and time again, you know, those are the more interesting cases of lawyers who decide to mix business with pleasure.
Yes.
And it's just, it's pleasurable for me. So hopefully they won't stop anytime soon. I got kids. I got a kid going to college a couple of years. But it might be nice for everybody else if they stop.
Some of those are head scratchers to be sure. But Sean, I got to tell you, the best thing that's happened to our business is the advent of the video camera in the courtroom and YouTube. I think those two combined together is great for our business.
Yes, it is. And, you know, you and I do some of those same cases. The advice that I always have, you know, especially before the courtroom brawl breaks out, is you got to throw the first punch. everyone in that fight is going to lose their license anyway. You might as well get a good blow.
Get the first punch. John, I almost became material for one of your classes, I got to tell you. I was in New Jersey, and I was driving for a gig in New Jersey, and my phone was there on the dashboard, and it's my GPS. I had no idea where I was going.
Never absolutely. Been okay, right. Before,
right? So I touched my phone because the GPS was going off, and a cop happened to pass me at that exact moment, saw me touch my phone, pulled me over and said, "Are you touching your phone?" What are you talking about? Am I touching my phone? It's my GPS. Are you touching your phone? So you admit you were touching your phone. Right? It's my GPS. He wrote me a ticket, Sean, for touching my phone. But guess what? In New Jersey, that's not a ticket you can pay. You have to show up in court to address that issue. And so I had come from Kansas all the way back to New Jersey. So I'm there in court. And oh, boy, I was mad. I had to drive all the way from Kansas City to New Jersey just for this stupid rule. No, there was a part of me that just wanted to pull out a map. You know, those old folded up maps. I'm sure nowadays have no idea what the phrase, it's difficult, it's folding up a map or whatever. But nonetheless, I wanted to pull out one of these folded up maps, take it to court, and undo it and say, "Your Honor, no worries. I'm no longer going to be a menace to the society here in New Jersey. I've got a better solution. I'm going to pull out this map and use this while I am driving." You know what I remember? There's a video camera running up there in the corner of that courthouse.
You would have made the news. That would have been great.
I did not want to be the subject of my own class, and so I just paid the fine and went back home and just never made a deal of it. But, yeah, you got to remember.
Now, I'm impressed that you did that because there's an option that you just could have avoided New Jersey from now on.
That's another thought. Yes,
which,
yes.
Which, by the way, always a first thought for me, just generally speaking.
That is not a bad thought. But, yeah, I did not want that kind of video to go viral. But, you know, speaking of going viral, Sean, you actually recently had a story where something you did went viral and landed you on CNN. But before we get there, I want to play a word association game. I'm sure your audience a bit that we're going to get to your viral story here in just a bit. But first, I want to play our word association game where I want to give you a word or a phrase, and I want you to tell me the first thing that comes to your mind. Are you ready?
Okay.
All right. Hollywood movie.
Into the Spider-Verse. I just saw it today. Spider-Man movie, Into the Spider-Verse.
All right, is that a good movie?
Horrible.
All right. Don't
ever let your kids pick out the movie. Right. But it was a matinee at 10:10 on a Wednesday morning. And that is one of those things you do. And I suggest you do this as well. That to me is what I do to compensate for not having a steady income or health care, is that, or paying for my own health care, is that I will go to a movie at 10:10 because people who have jobs and respect in the community can't do that. So I do that type of thing. Even if it's a bad movie, I enjoy it.
Yeah. My take from that was, all right, yeah, you live the good life. You are going to movies at 10 o'clock in the morning on a Wednesday. So that's a good life if you can get it. All right. Next one, football.
Super Bowl.
Super Mario, do you have a favorite team coming up?
No, I'm trying to figure out which team I hate the most. I think it is, or the least, I can't tell. I hate the Patriots because I'm American. Everybody hates the Patriots.
Okay, exactly.
But the other part is, though, is that the Rams, which I should like, and you know, got this wonderful young 30-year-old head coach, but I saw a video last week where they have a get-back coach that's largely responsible for keeping this fool off the field.
That's right.
And I'm like, wait a minute. You're a grown man paying $1 million, and you can't be responsible for your own geo-positioning place on the planet, right? You're just not to be on the field, that you do nothing. You have nothing reason to be on the field anyway. So I can't tell between whether I hate the coach of the Rams more or the entire Patriot organization. I think I'm going to end up going rooting for the Rams.
All right, Rams. Good. I like that because, you know, I'm a big Kansas City Chiefs fan, so I'm not too fond of the Patriots right now.
Hey,
right.
At least you guys won some playoff games this year. I was surprised.
We won one. Hey, the future looks bright for us. So
it does.
All right, Justice Scalia.
Funny.
Funny, yes. I like that.
He was, and politically we're not on the same end of the spectrum, but I liked that Scalia, and it was probably, it wasn't personality fit, the justice was closest to me. And this is how the way Scalia looked at the world. Do you agree with me or are you stupid?
That's right.
And how he was able to live with 9 people that he called stupid, almost every opinion, is amazing to me. Right. But somehow, and also he created words, not created words. He had a great, you know, 14th century vocabulary, things like argle bargle, and my favorite term I like to use, the curtilage.
The curtilage.
You know what the curtilage is?
I do. Explain it though.
It's the area around your home, not just inside, but the area that you still have a right of privacy to, the porch and your back swing. And basically, and there was one opinion where Scalia said, in a sense, people all up in my curtilage and don't know the flavor. Right? Stay out my curtilage. And so I've been a big fan of Scalia. He gives me new Scrabble words and was funny opinions. I missed the guy.
I got to tell you, I think Scalia was a trash talker extraordinaire at the Supreme Court. So I remember what was the case? The case was the Obamacare 3 case, the King v. Burwell, Obamacare 3, as I call it. And in that case, he called the majority opinion pure jiggery pokery.
You remember that? Jiggery pokery, that's right. See, that was another one. But that's even too long. You can't even do that Scrabble. You need like, you know, two or three sets. If you put jiggery pokery in Scrabble, you cheat.
No, my first thought was, when I read Jiggery Pokery, I know Supreme Court justices have power, but are they allowed to actually make up words in a Supreme Court? It's not a real world. In that same opinion, he also said this. He said, the majority opinion is pure applesauce. Now, Sean, I know you like to play basketball, and you're a little bit of trash talker on the basketball court, but I would not suggest using that as trash talk on the basketball court. Pure applesauce, but that is trash talk at the Supreme Court level.
So yeah, he is missed. I miss him. Nobody is even close. On you know, on the left, we have Ruth Bader Ginsburg, but she's not quite at that level. She actually keeps mostly within the what would be the word for it, in the Webster's Dictionary.
Right? Yes, yes. You played a little bit more to the book. Now, speaking of Notorious RBG, you do know who Scalia's best friend on the court was, don't you?
Absolutely. Baby Ruth.
That's right. And so how bad of a guy was Scalia really when his best friend off on the court was Notorious RBG? I'm thinking the media might have misrepresented him just a bit.
Well, and then the thing that's interesting was is that, you know, he was very strident in his opinions, but apparently he didn't take it personally. And amazingly, the people whom he insulted didn't take it personally.
Right, right. That's just how the game is played. So.
It wasn't that he ever called them stupid, but he would often sort of make the implication that, basically, you know, you've ruined Western civilization, right, with this opinion, decision.
Right.
And dogs and cats are going to start sleeping together. Justin Bieber's going to sing Motown, right? You know, this is the end of the world.
Right, right. All right, next one. Funny comedian.
Oh, Chris Rock.
All right, Chris Rock. I like that. Good one. This is an interesting one. Twerking.
I'm going to plead the fifth. I'm watching twerking videos while we're talking now. What can I say? It's disturbing and yet somewhat interesting. I got to plead the fifth. I mean, my wife might listen to this podcast. I really don't know what to say.
All right, we'll keep it PG. All right, so how about last one here, Marissa Tomei.
All I can think of is My Cousin Vinny, and my time clock is ticking.
Oh, yes.
Or whatever that clock was. Has she done anything since My Cousin Vinny?
Oh, I don't know. She doesn't have to do anything since My Cousin Vinny. Good that point. Is a classic. She was 23, won the Academy Award, I believe, for supporting actress. Amazing job. Oh, I love it. Yeah, she stomped her foot down. She said, biological clock.
That's the biological clock. It's ticking. Yep, that's all she ever needs to do again.
Well, thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a 5-star review. We need your love to help us continue highlighting the funnier side of the law. I want to give a special shout out to our Vice President of Operations, Wendy Oster, without whom, well, let's face it, this entire operation would be a mess. Our marketing team, Redbird Solutions, and Leanne Holmberg for spreading the good word about us. Sean Wynn and 15.5 Features for making me sound way better than I actually do. And Ryan Kuhn and Paul Kuhn of Triplicity Marketing for our technical and computer support.